Hi, I'm Dr. Kat Lewitsky, and welcome to Psych Confidential, where we cover no-nonsense mental health discussions. This is episode 4. Today, we will be talking about suicide. Trigger warning, this is a very sensitive yet important topic and can be emotionally difficult to both talk about and hear. If you are struggling with self-harm and suicidal thoughts, please call the suicide hotline at 988. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is a United States-based suicide prevention network that provides a free 24/7 phone hotline. Again, that number is 988. My goal today is to provide hope for those who are currently struggling with suicidal contemplation, as well as support for those who have had to experience the unfortunate loss of a loved one to taking their own life. Suicide is the 12th overall leading cause of death in the United States, 9th for ages 10 to 64, and is the second highest cause of death for college students ages 18 to 24. 80% of suicides are carried out by males, with men over the age of 65 being at the greatest risk. 20% of postpartum deaths are at the result of suicide, and suicide attempts both during pregnancy and after childbirth are increasing, nearly tripling over the past decade. And with the COVID pandemic, we have seen a reported 25 to 30% increase in the prevalence of anxiety and depression worldwide. And an increase in emotional struggles often indicates an increased risk for suicide. Today's guest is Matthew Schwartz. Matt is a licensed social worker. His expertise have taken him beyond psychotherapist, branching into additional areas such as public speaker, business owner, and coach. He also focuses on healing, personal growth, and deep transformation. His mission is to help people reduce stress, heal pain, grow joy, and build fulfilling lives. Matt is a director of training and development at PCS in Northville, Michigan, the owner and CEO of Evolving Lives, a therapy and personal growth company founded by himself and his wife, Sarah, and the chief flow officer at Recess Labs, where they utilize the latest brain technology to help users to reach flow state. Matt also has provided consultation and training to Fortune 500 companies, national organizations, and school systems. So Matt, welcome to the show.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you are a very achieved clinician. We were talking a little bit before the show at length about it. And so I'd like to know more about your clinical experience and the populations that you work with, too. Yeah.
So especially for this podcast, let me start with a little in the beginning.
Yeah.
When I graduated with my master's in social work, I originally concentrated on DBT. Dialectical behavioral therapy.
Okay.
I was working in prisons. I was in New York at the time, working in Rikers Island. So like some really intense populations dealing with suicidal ideation, self-harm, borderline personality disorder, some of the really tough stuff. As I moved on in my career and began figuring out what I was really good at, I think as it does for a lot of people, you find some of your strengths in the things that you've dealt with, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've had bad anxiety. I've had panic. You know, grew up with ADHD, and so I began gravitating more towards those things than the things I was originally trained in. And as that unfolded, I've moved more into trauma-informed care. I specialize in, I do a lot of EMDR, a lot of IFS parts work, but my real strength comes in dealing with, like, high achievers, high performers, executives, different people who are really looking to, like, build a rich, fulfilling life. And even sometimes, talking about working with leaders, that could be a stay-at-home mom, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't
right.
mean you need to have a, you know, be a CEO or have some giant credential. It's just a leader is somebody who wants to make an impact, right? So I love to work with people who want to make an impact so that I can help them make an impact and that, you know, can just radiate out, right? How do we positively transform the world? little by little.
Yeah. So you're talking about, like, you know, people that are like these leaders, these high achievers, and that doesn't have to be like this stereotypical CEO, because you can be a very like high achieving mom too. Absolutely. Which I've heard other moms come in and they see these moms on like TikTok and they're like, how am I supposed, like, Halloween's coming up, like, how am I supposed to decorate my house for Halloween to look this like perfect decor, right? So I guess, like, tell me more, like, what exactly, like, with the research with like high achievers, like, what does that look like? How does that relate to like even like mental health, or, you know, just working with that kind of population too? Like, what have you seen?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, my work started out the way you might expect it to start, which is, okay, how can I get more done at work? How can I focus better? How can I balance all of these different priorities? How can I decrease stress? You know, all the sort of common things, again, whether it's at home or at work, all of that. But as time went on, it became very clear that the biggest issue that high achievers suffer with is, you know, just an addiction to perfectionism, right? Like, I have to be awesome or I'm not okay, right? So they're drawing all of their worth from their achievements, and there is no exponential growth trajectory, right? Sooner or later, you're going to hit a wall. You're going to experience pain. There's going to be a loss. There's going to be change, right? The normal things every single human has to go through. And most high achievers think they can protect themselves from that. If I just do everything perfect, sooner or later, something happens. Like, for instance, my clients who have lost a loved one to suicide. And so then they just get stuck in, what did I do wrong? How could I fix it? How can I prevent it from happening again?
Yeah.
But there's deeper trauma there. And, you know, I certainly went through that. I grew up in Northville, Michigan. I grew up in a high achieving culture. You know, I was a high achiever. And looking back, the more I've done this work, the like, oh my God, I have trauma from this.
Yeah.
Like, serious trauma.
Like, trying to get to an end point, and where is that end point?
There is none. Yeah. Right? There's no, you get to the top of the mountain and then, okay, next mountain. Or I feel empty.
Or this mountain isn't high enough.
Totally. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And so it just.
Or, oh, that's it. Like, this is it. No, where's that next thing? It's almost like an addiction in itself, or like some high that, you know, 100%. Someone's trying to achieve and it's never fulfilling enough.
100%.
So, like, when you work with these patients, now the ones that you're working with are the ones who have lost someone to suicide. Now, are those patients the one with the perfectionistic qualities, or is it usually the ones who have, unfortunately, you know, like, committed suicide themselves who are the more perfectionistic ones? Like, what is it that you typically see when you're working with patients?
I mean, they're really sort of, I'm referring to separate groups.
Okay. Right?
So, and there may be some Venn diagram overlap.
Yeah.
But I ended up like kind of stumbling into this accidentally. So the long story short is I was asked by a local not-for-profit called New Hope Center for Grief Support, who, by the way, they run free grief support services, workshops, ongoing groups for people who have lost different loved ones and different losses. They're really awesome. Encourage anybody who is dealing with grief to look up New Hope Center for Grief Support. Okay. They do amazing work. They asked me to lead a group for loss due to suicide. This was 7 years ago. I had training in complicated grief. I had no idea what I was doing, you know, but I wanted.
That's how you grow as a clinician. Ready, you have to keep pushing yourself. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I did groups in prison. So at that point, it's like, oh, it can't get harder than that. You know, I'll do that group. Right. And so the first, I had a co-facilitator who had lost her husband to suicide. And I just learned so much from her and just tried to soak up so much from the group. So I'd say after doing that for 2 or 3 years, I was pretty, gained a pretty significant expertise, and I started taking on individual clients who had lost loved ones to suicide. Mm-hmm. It branched out a little into like other traumatic losses, but it's really kind of stayed like that. But the majority of people I see, you know, I grew up from Northville, so a lot of the people are in that Northville, Plymouth community, and they're very high achieving communities. So there are a lot of like high achieving families.
A lot of pressure too that probably gets passed down generationally.
Oh, absolutely. And so, you know, if I'm working with the parents, it's like, oh yeah, I mean, the trauma's right there. And it originally, the way my work ends up going is they come in for the grief work, but they stay for the trauma work. And so in this like really beautiful but obviously challenging way, their biggest pain and their biggest loss is this incredible invitation into healing, you know? And not everybody can go there, and that's totally okay. You know, if you just need to like, okay, how do I adjust to this loss? How do I move on? Totally. But if And this is not something to ask of anybody in the early grief process at all. But if you're like, I lost somebody to suicide like 8 years ago, 10 years ago, like I still feel like it happened yesterday. Like mm-hmm. I'm not over it. Yeah, man, you're stuck in trauma. Like it's the trauma yeah. of the loss, but it's also the trauma that existed before the loss right. that is preventing you from healthfully processing through the loss. And so you just try to unwind those layers of the onion to help not just adjust to the loss, but do the deeper healing work if they're ready for it.
Yeah. And, you know, I always think to myself too, that like, you know, everyone's going to lose somebody in their life, you know, just, we don't know how, when that loss is going to happen, how that loss is going to happen. So everyone's going to experience some type of grief. And I think the hard thing is with suicide is that, it's, you know, we always try to like prevent it, or we're always trying to think, well, what did I do to maybe cause it, or what could I have done to stop it? Whereas like if somebody has like some type of illness, it's like, okay, well, you know, that is something that, you know, happened to that person, got sick or something, right? Or like a car accident, it was like out of their control. But like with suicide, we're like, well, this person made this decision yeah. to do this, right? And yeah. we talk about that even a lot, like in graduate school, you know, you know, like what, I mean, like, is this something that can even be prevented? I mean, I think about like even like with, you know, duty to warn, and that's something that we talked about in graduate school. So like duty to warn is obviously like if a patient comes in and everything's confidential, but if they say that they have a plan and so forth and the means to carry it out, we have to break that confidentiality. And do you think that that's something that is like helpful for the patients? Do you think it's something that's not? I mean, and you're...
You're asking wonderful but complicated questions.
It is really complicated. Yeah, it is. Because you don't want to, like, you know, we have this therapeutic alliance where we want to have this relationship with our patients. But then when our patients are coming in, part of that is them disclosing these suicidal thoughts that they might have. But then we have to just basically bolt out and say, okay, well, now we have to go and break our confidentiality at the same time, too.
I don't think there's a simple answer to the question. I can share some thoughts, right? I think a lot of times duty to warn is more for the clinician mm-hmm. than it is for the client, right? That it's about protecting myself.
Right.
Right. What if something bad happens? What if somebody sues me? You know, then it is like you sit there and you go, what's in the best interest of the client? And most of the time it's, I shouldn't do anything, you know? And so there's this tension there. I think that the intention of duty to warn is based on some healthy sort of like collectivist principles. Which is like, we're not singular individuals, we're part of a community, we need to take care of that community. And that's all well and good, but that is not where our culture is at. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a part of my whole spiel on suicide is like, we're living in a sick culture, and the sick culture creates sick people, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, duty to warn is great. Let's create a culture that actually reflects that, right? Why does it take until somebody is saying, oh, I'm going to kill myself, before we intervene, before right. we help them? Where are the interventions that come earlier than that? Where is our duty to keep people safe? Where is our yes. duty to keep people connected? I took a trip, honeymoon, it was like a baby moon trip to yeah. Maui, okay? And at night, you drive around the island, you get past the tourist part of the island. We were staying on the non-tourist part of the island. You drive through these communities. They have these community centers. It's beautiful. Every night, there are hundreds of people every night at these community centers.
Yeah.
They're not staying in their little boxes and watching their television. They're going and hanging out with all of
with
the
others
people
or connecting themselves
every single day, right?
Yeah.
Our culture doesn't support that. Where do you go for that?
Well, it's like we've lost that.
Right.
You know, I mean, even being a mom and, you know, that whole like support of it too. It's like, you know, they say like it takes a village to raise a family.
Yeah. Where's my village?
There's no village. Yeah. There really isn't. And you need that for your kids too. And for your own, you know, I guess your own health, mental health as a mom yeah. too. Because when I was researching for this podcast and I discovered how so many women, you know, 20% of all postpartum deaths are related to suicide. I mean, to me, that was really alarming. Like, I had my second during COVID, and I look back and I don't know if I really had like postpartum depression or not, but I don't know if it was just like that whole like COVID anxiety and like being withdrawn from others. But I think about that. I'm like, that is just so alarming that it keeps increasing. Well, it's increasing because there's no support for women. And especially during that time, like with COVID now and everything else is even less accessible. I mean, sure, you have like you can do things. We figured out things more virtually, I guess, with technology, but it's not the same of, hey, I need to go and shower, or I need to go eat, I need to take care of myself, and you have other kids in the house, and there's really no Everything's, it's all cut off.
You're in survival mode, and there's fight or flight. No connection to help. And the only adjustment in our culture is, okay, well, creative community, most of the time it's oriented around capitalism. Mm-hmm. I need to pay this person to do this. I need to pay this person to do that. I'll find a community through my, you know, daycare, right? Like,
yeah.
it's organized around, you know, money. Yeah. Or maybe you're one of the rare ones who has like a really good connected family,
yeah,
which is becoming even less and less and less common, yes, right? Certainly not true for me. You know, we've had to figure it out, right? And yeah, I mean, it's devastating. I can't imagine being a mom, you know, trying to, you know, and there's all of those expectations of mm-hmm. what you've dreamed for 20 years, whatever, what it's supposed to look like,
yeah,
and it doesn't look that way, and, you know, nobody's going to get it. You're a mom. Like, the husband, you know, I'm there. I'm a husband, but I don't get it,
yeah,
you know, right? I mean, like, I could see it, but I don't get it.
Yeah.
And it's, you're alone.
Yeah.
And either you have a loving mom in your life or a loving maternal figure mm-hmm. who can, like, really get in there with you. Most people don't have that.
Yeah.
So line up 20 women in a room and assume four of them are going to commit suicide in their postpartum experience. Yeah.
It's alarming.
I see that. Yeah. It makes perfect sense why people would feel that way.
Yeah. And even, like, the support follow-up, too. You know, I think that, you know, when you're talking about, like, okay, we have to address this trauma to, like, help with, like, you know, to even, like, before we even get to all, like, the suicidal thoughts and all that as well, too, it's the same thing. Even, like, you know, going to my postpartum visit, they're, like, checking things off a box. And I think sometimes even clinicians can get into that robotic mode of, okay, am I doing the steps? Am I doing this? Am I doing it? But they're not really getting into that.
Have I done my suicide risk assessment?
Yeah.
Have
I did it. You know, okay.
Did I do
check off
safety planning? Mm-hmm. Make this client sign the safety planning document that they don't want to do.
Right.
You're eating up 45 minutes of their life. They don't want to do a safety planning document. We got to do it for insurance. It's really important, right? Best practice. Got to do it. I'm not saying don't do these things. Right. I'm just saying,
is it really going to prevent or help? Or, yeah, I guess. Yeah.
It's like, what? And sometimes it does. And so again, you know, we all have our niche, right? I took a step back from the DBT world. That wasn't my world. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do the suicide risk assessments. I don't want to put my face right up against clients who are actively suicidal. I can't. It's not my skill set. I don't have the experience. I've never felt suicidal, like, maybe mm-hmm. moments, right? But not like prolonged ideation.
Right.
I'm anxious. I have panic attacks. I make everybody around me assure me that I'm okay. Like, that's my bullshit. Like, I'll work with those people.
Yeah.
You know, I'll work with the people that I can understand. I'll work with the people who have lost loved ones to suicide mm-hmm. that I can understand. As I shared with you before, you know, I myself have lost somebody to suicide. I actually had an early loss in my life that was probably even more impactful than that. Like you said, everybody lose somebody.
Yeah.
There are really awesome people doing suicide prevention work. There's really awesome people doing suicide risk assessment work, doing, you know, triage work. Like, all of that's super important. We all mm-hmm. have our purpose. We all have our place. I don't want to make anybody feel like what they're doing is not important,
right,
or feel like any part of this process isn't important. But I'm outside of it, and I'm looking at things from after it happens and way before it happens. And how do I, you know?
You know, I also think, too, that there's also this, like, disconnect, because when people, you know, if they, like, you have, like, the triage, you have, like, the crisis centers, you have people who do private mental health, you have inpatient hospitals. I mean, everything is just so disconnected, and I think that, I mean, we understand it, but as when the patients are calling and they're just trying to get in and just try to find some answers, yeah, they don't really know this language, right? And they're trying to navigate and find out. And then they kind of probably feel even more hopeless because they're probably just hitting brick walls 100%. At that point.
So you call your primary care physician, you say, mm-hmm. hey, my son is feeling suicidal. What do I do? They go, I don't know. Here's the number for the hospital, you know, like,
right,
or, you know, maybe they have a really good clinician, you know, that they can refer you to,
right,
or maybe they have a really good treatment center, but not everybody does. And like you said, it's so disjointed. And those of us who work in the field mm-hmm. understand, like, even like sending a client to inpatient, like, you don't get the communication you need from that.
Right.
Right. You see them in 30 days. Good luck. You know, and you're trying to communicate with, maybe it's a really good place.
Right.
Maybe you hear from the therapist twice the whole time, you know, like,
you get a fax.
Yeah. You get a, yeah, here's the discharge yeah. paperwork. Right.
Yeah.
Like, it's, and again, but this is a symptom. Mm-hmm. This isn't the problem. The disconnection in the systems
yeah.
mirror the disconnection individually. It's, you know, it's turtles all the way down. The disconnection is everywhere. And it's different in America than it is in other places.
What have you seen differently, like mental health and then the health and support that you get here versus other places?
I probably am not the best person to speak to this because I don't have a ton of really awesome, like, intercultural knowledge. I've spent the majority of, you know, all my life in America, right? Yeah. But from my understanding, talking to other people, right, in terms of, like, living in Europe, right, there's so much more emphasis on connection and friendship and, you know, time spent after work. Work isn't life, right? You get off work and then you go to life, right? And life is, I'm going to go get tapas with my friends, right? Like, that's...
There's more like a community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is in my understanding, right? I can't, again, I can't speak to a lot of other places.
Right.
But what I can speak to is I can speak to, again, especially high achieving American culture, you know, the focus on hierarchy, the focus on exponential growth, you know, these things that create certain sacrifices, right? And some of those sacrifices line up directly with mental health vulnerabilities, sacrifices like, okay, we're not concerned about keeping people safe. What does that even mean?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay, somebody's not shooting you in the face. No, but like safety, we know as clinicians, there's physical safety and there's psychological safety.
Right?
What does that look like? There's, you know, again, you're talking to the worst kind of clinician because I'm a social worker, right? So I'm not just thinking about the individual. I'm thinking about all
the greater thing,
layered
yeah.
systems, right? And I don't want to make it sound doom and gloom. I think every person that changes and every little change, you know, makes a ripple effect, right? And so I'm always looking for, again, that's why I love working with leaders and influencers, is like, who are the people who are have been affected by this stuff, who want to make an impact? And that's where I'm going to go. I'm not saying that's the right place for everybody, but that's the place that really excites me.
Yeah, so we were talking a little bit before, too, about how emotional intelligence relates to grit, right? So we know that there is this, like, correlation between the two with, like, emotional intelligence, which is, like, being able to really, like, understand other things around you, and then, like, grit, which is that perseverance to try to move forward, and then how those two things correlate together and you become a high achiever, right? But then now what the research is showing is that if you have high grit, then you also are at a risk for more like suicidal ideations, right? So I guess I'm wondering, like, have you seen that working with high achievers, like this like combination of these people who are highly emotionally intelligent, they have strong grit, they're very successful, they're high achievers, and then that suicidality kind of playing in, is that like too much grit, is it not enough emotional, like where's that balance, and like where do you see it?
I think let me start big picture and then get practical, if that's okay. I'm gonna do a little history lesson. So in early 1700s Europe, there was this movement called the European Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And if you boil this movement down, the movement says humans can master their life through logic. If we become logical creatures and we fight our emotional tendencies and animal impulses, then we can be the best versions of ourselves, right? Nietzsche, Kierkegaard, all this kind of stuff, right? Okay, who was hanging around these people? Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, right? So these people that founded our country imported this, you know, this logic above all else mentality, coupled with rugged American exceptionalism, right? And so you combine these things together, and we've been in, plus the sort of puritanical, you know, Christian based, like life is suffering and the more you suffer, the closer you are to God thing, which is not necessarily all Christianity, but puritanical, right? Mm-hmm. Which was, you know, Puritans were a big part of the founding of our country. So you have these different cultural influences that all meld together to create this ideal American who's tough, who has grit and perseverance and can conquer their emotions and bootstrap themselves all the way up to J.P. Morgan level and own the railroads and, you know, frack their way through the country and all that, right? Then you come back to real life and you have a 9-year-old sitting in a classroom being asked to sit still and shut up and copy the homework, and they're feeling all types of things because there's a 9-year-old and it's
child,
it's emotional development. They're not ready to memorize American history, maybe. they need to figure out what are they feeling and why are they feeling it and how do they connect with people. And so we've also interrupted the natural developmental process.
You know? Yeah, I see that. Like, kids aren't playing as long as they used to.
100%.
I mean, I play with dolls, honestly, up to like probably sixth grade. Yeah. And now it's like kids are probably stopping at like first, maybe second grade, and they're just switching right to technology early on. Yeah. I see it.
If you know, one of the keys, there's this model I have, right? But one of the five keys to a fulfilling life is play.
Yes.
And even as an adult, right? What are we doing right now? Right. In some ways, this is play. Mm-hmm. Right. This is what we like to do. We like to have these conversations mm-hmm. and get together with people who inspire us and explore new
ideas. It's engagement. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So thank God we can find ways of doing it. Right. But if you're not given the natural developmental ability to understand your emotions and play and connect with community. Right. So, of course, we're in all of these conflicts. Mm-hmm. Of course, this little 9-year-old girl who doesn't know how to deal with all the feelings that come when she goes to sleep at night, right? There's all these big feelings she doesn't know what to do with. Or maybe she feels excluded from her peers. Or maybe she doesn't understand all the schoolwork. Or maybe she feels disconnected because her parents are working all the time, mm-hmm. right? So it doesn't have to
be. And locked into their phones when they're not working,
100%,
too.
Right? Yep. And so I'm not talking about anything like crazy or weird, right? I'm talking about normal daily life, yeah. right? And gosh, so we're just like, we're adrift. And we as adults, we know it. You know, what was promised to us, you know, you grew up probably the same time I did, right? We had mm-hmm. this beautiful picture of the life always looking like the 90s, right?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, and everybody always getting what they wanted. And,
yep.
And we get here and we're like, oh, no, this is, they didn't tell us. They didn't warn us.
Reality hits.
This is messy, right? Why didn't they tell us how messy this was? Why did they tell us that we could control every aspect of our life when you obviously can't? Why did they tell us that the schoolwork was more important than the relationships mm-hmm. when it's obviously not? Right? So it's right. all, this has been going on for.
And that's actually, I have this whole issue with homework. And, you know, I have two kids and my son's still in preschool, but next year he's going to kindergarten. And just the thought of homework to me, just, it seems almost traumatizing in a way too, because we're basically setting people up. Like, you have these young kids, they've already been sitting for what, like 8 hours during the day. Then they're expected to come home and do, which now seems like, honestly, when I hear
an
parents
hour,
talk,
two
like,
hours, 3 hours. Yeah, crazy.
I'm like,
and again, these
how
are
they going to have time?
And 9-year-olds, yes. right? What did my grandpa, you know, I talked to my grandpa all the time. What did he do? He got home and he went and played baseball for 4 hours.
That's what kids should be doing.
Right? Like, you know, and you hear, you know.
This homework is just setting them up to go and then you to go and work these extra long hours. And it's just totally normal. And
it's working exactly the way it was designed to work.
Yes.
We are teaching children how to be good corporatists. And it's working. But people are dying, you know. And I mean, like, back to the problem, right?
Yeah.
People are feeling, if you don't teach a child how to connect with themselves, don't be surprised they're watching TV and on their phone as an adult. If you don't teach a child how to build community, don't be surprised that when they have their first kid, they look around and they realize there's no community around them mm-hmm. to support them. We haven't taught them the essential building blocks of humanity, right? And you go, oh, the parents are supposed to. Yeah, but if both parents are working 50 hours a week,
right.
you know. And like,
and now people are having kids older, which means that their parents are also older too. And that's making it more difficult for the parents to also help the new parents.
So you're in the weeds and you can see there's actually 50 issues going on here,
mm-hmm.
right? And you come back to the suicide question, like, oh, somebody's in my office. They're presenting with suicidal ideation. Well, you know, turn back to the 50 things we just talked about. Well, it's about what's their relationship with their parents and what did they get and what did they not get and what developmental cycles were interrupted and what was their school experience and what are the demands on their life right now? Where do they go to feel safe? Where do they go to feel loved? Where do they go to find purpose, right?
Mm-hmm.
And anybody in that state is not going to be like, oh, I've got it all handled. Like, no, obviously they don't. Otherwise, you know, the majority of the time, there are rare exceptions, but the majority of the time, maybe they have one or two of those things locked in. But they're suffering, they're alone, they're disconnected. And, you know, we're seeing it more and more in children, right? We're seeing, you know, you referred to the statistic about, you know, guys who, it's basically post-retirement males. I'm I spent 40 years working.
And working long hours. Yeah. And then it just gets cut off. And
suddenly
then what?
I have 60 hours a week back. What do I do? Watch TV for 60 hours, right? Like
that purpose isn't gone, there.
Right. And we haven't, there's no ramp up or ramp down time to sort of like, okay, let's make this change slowly. Let's figure out how to build, you know. But again, if we're not taught, what are we going to do? Okay, go build community. Well, I don't know how to build community. I'm 65.
Right.
All my friends are friends that they were either my kids' parents, you know, like at school, or they were work people. I don't know how to, what hobbies? I'm working 60 hours a week. My hobby is the TV.
It's like, you know, that's like their identity, their sense of self. And then it gets completely just cut off.
Totally. And we again, the layers, right, in our sort of achievement culture, we value purpose before connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so, oh, great, you've got purpose. You know, if you're one of the lucky ones that has purpose, well, great. Yeah, but I don't have connection. And then even more core, when you look at the brain region that is responsible for suicide stuff, right? It's your hindbrain. It's your survival self, right? It's in connection with the limbic system, in connection with the emotion system. But that survival system is all about safety. I ask a patient, like, how do you feel about your level of safety? They don't know how to answer that question. We've never been taught about psychological safety.
Yeah.
How do I feel safe? They can talk to me about coping skills, or they can talk to me about self-care. But they don't understand how to navigate through the fact that, whatever, early developmental traumas created a nervous system in which they can't feel
safe. And they
safe.
May not even recognize it at that time.
Oh, they don't know. They don't know. They have no idea. I mean, there are people that I will, high performers that will be like, I don't have anxiety. It's like, I'm seeing you shaking and biting your fingers in front of me.
Yeah.
You have anxiety, let alone, you know, I'm angry all the time. You're depressed. What do you mean I'm depressed? I'm not sad. I'm not crying. Yeah, that's depression, right?
Yeah.
People can barely identify the anxiety and the depression. We're getting better at that. We're educating better.
And we see it even coming in when people come in for testing, because I do the neuropsych testing, and they'll come in and they'll say, well, I have ADHD, and we'll test them and we say, well, actually, you don't have ADHD. You have anxiety or depression, and maybe they have ADHD with other things too, but sometimes it comes in and we're like, you actually don't have ADHD.
No.
You may have trauma, that anxiety, depression, or something else emotional going on that's causing all of this other brain fog that's making it difficult for you to focus.
Totally. And I find time and time again, well, let me speak about me, right? I was diagnosed with ADHD in second grade. I was given medication for 10 years. I was in therapy for 10 years. You know, I mean, treatment as usual, right? Best treatment, late 90s, right? That was traumatizing, because the message that was given to me was, you need to fix yourself in order to be okay, right? Versus there are underlying emotional issues that are creating this specific constellation of symptoms, right? And in your, you know, the cases you're talking about, and even people who don't have, but, you know, they have some tendencies or whatever, right? The anxiety, the depression, these different comorbid factors that are exacerbating the challenge, like, how can a regular person weed through all of that? You know, you need an expert to come in and see that from the outside. But even then, most people are not sure how to engage with that, right? I can tell you all of these things, but then you go, what do I do, right? And so it's so seductive for somebody to say, here are the 8 signs of, you know, suicidality, you know? And just like,
it's more complex than that.
It's so much more, but I appreciate, right? Yeah. I understand there's a time and a place, and parents just need a list of 8 things to look for. Okay, I get it, but the real issue is you're disconnected, so your children are disconnected. And unless we get in there and, you know,
it's like a whole system issue.
It's a whole system issue. Yeah. Depending on the view you're looking at it from, it's either a cultural issue or it's a spiritual issue. And, you know, maybe both, but not if you're not spiritual, then it's not. Then it's just a cultural issue, right? But it's deep. You know, how do we connect to ourselves? What does that even mean? Who am I, really, right? Am I just layers of cultural conditioning? Am I just what my parents taught me to be?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a seed in there of, like, whatever you call that, authentic self, right, that I need to work to discover? In my work, that has seemed really important. But I understand there are people that don't necessarily, that language may not be appealing. And so then other ways to explain that would be, again, like, yeah, I am essentially a combination of things I was taught to be. But what do I want to be? Okay, so say there's no seed. Say there's no authentic self. Well, then you have full freedom. Who do you want to be? Rather than who do you feel like you have to be in order to survive.
Like you're masking.
Yeah, 100%, right? Oh, I'll go to work and I'll do this thing, or I'll show up this way. I'll be codependent with my partner. I'll, you know, be a people pleaser at work. I'll, you know, all these things because I'm trying to get love and connection. But I'm never going to get enough through those windows.
Well, I think that's why, like, even when you think about, like, you know, observable signs of suicide, right, to try to prevent it. And sometimes there really aren't a whole lot of signs because if somebody is masking themselves so well emotionally, 100%. You know, then really what can you do at that point to even prevent it if they're not really being authentic with anything or genuine in these conversations or confiding in somebody to tell them, hey, I'm suffering inside. How can the work really start then if they're not even willing to be genuine or authentic, right? And they're scared to be.
They're scared to be because they've been conditioned that's not safe. Mm-hmm. Whether that was with their parents or at school or at work, at some point they got yelled at. You know, at some point they got left alone, rejected, right? It's not safe to be. So in IFS, Internal Family Systems, which is a trauma-informed therapy that works on parts, right? There's this whole idea that you're not just one thing. You are a collection of different parts, and these different parts serve different protective functions in order to keep you safe and functioning, right? Mm-hmm. In that view, which I really like, in that view, somebody who has a suicidal part, we want to get curious about it, right? Like, oh, how does this serve you? What is this? How has this protected you? Mm-hmm. How has this helped you, right? This isn't just a dysfunction. This is an adaptive mechanism, right? What's going on here? Why do people do this, right? Well, having even an imaginary way that the pain could go away, because that's really how it starts. Most people don't want to die. They don't want to commit. They don't want to take their own life. Sorry. That language, committed suicide, like a lot of people, that's not healthy or helpful language, right? Yeah. And I fall back into it because that's what I was trained in, right?
Right.
But people who take their own lives, they just want the pain to stop.
Right.
They don't want to die. They don't want to hurt anybody else. But they don't have any other part. They don't have any other coping that's as effective for taking away the pain. How do I make the pain stop?
And they see that almost as like an end, like this is the only way to cure my pain.
It grows and it grows and it grows and it grows. And you can manage it for a certain while. But if that part is doing the heavy lifting, if every time you feel in pain, a part goes, yeah, but you could just end it all and the pain would be over, and you experience even a 20 or 30 or 40% decrease in pain, that part grows and that part grows. And as with any part, there are advantages and disadvantages. Oh, it's super advantageous to succeed at work. We'll call that like an achiever part. But there's also disadvantages. I'm not seeking out connection and community, maybe, or I'm just constantly trying to please people in order to get love, right? So,
or maybe those connections really aren't genuine. They're more like superficial. Like, oh, these are just like coworkers or someone I just like share a cubicle with or somebody I just pass in the hallway.
Economically motivated, right? Yes. I'll love you as long as you make me money. Mm-hmm. And then, sorry, I'm not going to pay attention to you anymore.
Right.
Right. So, you know, there are cases, we were talking about this, where it's just purely biological and chemical. And suicide, right? And I use the metaphor, it's like a heart attack, right? You have a brain attack where the survival part of your brain just goes haywire. And I see this all the time. Like, these kids are like, yeah, I mean, you know, maybe they had a little anxiety and depression, but like, they were seeing a therapist, or they were, you know, like, this wasn't some crazy, horrible case, but just one moment, right? Maybe they, you know, they were older and had something to drink and it just popped, right? Or maybe they didn't, and they were just there, and they just had one bad night.
Yeah.
And they'd had enough pain seeking out help that they didn't seek out help. And that one moment, everything's over, right? Maybe you are 67, and you don't know what's coming next, and this part has been growing for 40 years. And now that there's nothing,
you can't see, like, that light at the end of the tunnel.
There's
stuck.
There's no anything else. Everything, you just retired. Everything else has been stripped away. Now that part that's been slowly growing in the background is now big and loud and noisy. Boom, right? So there's sometimes where it's just like, boom, okay, like one moment. In most cases, this is something that's been growing for 5, 10, 20, 30 years.
Like a plant, yeah.
Like a plant, exactly. And so the idea that's like, oh, we found it. We'll just snip this off. We'll mm-hmm. just, you know, we'll just make this person not suicidal. Like, no, I mean, this is a project.
Well, there was, it was like almost 10 years ago, there was this guy who did take his own life. And I think it was maybe like his 60th birthday. And he created a website. So I guess what it was right before he decided to do that, he made this website and he launched it and he sent emails out that morning. Yeah. And then he went and, you know, he took his life. But on this website, he described like that he was planning this for years because he didn't have I think he was divorced and he didn't have any biological children. He had stepchildren, but they were from the marriage that he was divorced from. And he just, you know, he was worried about essentially dying alone. And he was worried about losing those connections with people as he got older. He described it like all on his website. And I can't remember what his name was or the name of the website, or if it's even still up. But it was about, I think, like maybe 8 years ago or something like that. And he described all in there, like his, it was like all these letters for everybody in there. And a lot of it was that he was worried about just being alone at the end of his life. So it was like right around his 60th birthday, he decided like the day he was going to do it, how he was going to do it. He created this website. And then launched it, you know, right before he ended up carrying out the act. And, yeah, I mean, but a lot of it was just, I mean, he planned it for a long time. I mean, he talked about it. He was like, look, I've been planning this. Like, this is my decision. I planned it. Like, please understand that this is what I think is best for me, too. And I think he really tried to, I guess, come across like that to all of his loved ones or other people who might have known him.
Yeah, but it's the challenge there is for those of us who haven't been in that place or made that decision,
mm-hmm.
this situation creates immense pain for us for different reasons, right? Well, I don't want to feel alone. You don't leave me, right? I'm not good with death. That feels unsafe to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like change. This is too abrupt of a change. I don't like loss. You know, like any of these triggers. So we feel pain. So we want to prevent it from happening. Right. How do I control this? How do I prevent this?
Because pain hurts.
Because pain hurts, and yeah. I don't want to hurt. And I don't know how to not make it hurt
mm-hmm.
because it touches all of these unaddressed wounds, right? So I said to you earlier, I was leading a loss to suicide group for about 6 years. And the last year, I had my aunt take her life.
Mm-hmm.
And, she, you know, I mean, look, in the whole scheme of things, was it my child? No. Was it my partner? No. Was it a parent? No, right? This is an aunt. So, you know, the connection wasn't like, oh my God, you know, I need this person in my life. So, but even that, even for somebody who's sitting there like working through this every day, every week, is like, oh my God, my body does not like this.
Right.
Like, it doesn't matter how much I know about this. It doesn't matter how much I've worked. Like, my body is like, no, this is bad. You can't touch this. You can't feel this. Like, my body needed time to process, even with all the training, even with all the skills, right? Let alone somebody who's never, you know,
yeah.
it's like hasn't equipped themselves or hasn't even thought about, oh, what if somebody I love takes their life? Like, no, it's going to hit you like a ton of bricks and there's nothing you can do about it. And it's horrible trauma. And, you know, your brain can't adjust to that, right? But the reality is, you know, people want there to be, okay, give me the five signs or give me the but there are people on the spectrum from the guy you told me about just now who, you know, has been planning this for years and has all of these things put together and the person who just, it was just one bad moment.
Right.
And then there's everything in between. So you can't say, oh, suicide is like this.
It's not like black or white.
Right, well, it's like depression or anxiety. It can come from so many different places. There's achievement anxiety, there's social anxiety,
mm-hmm.
there's, you know, early childhood trauma anxiety, and all of them show up a little differently, right? And so what do I do about anxiety? Ha! Great. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, sit down with me and we'll talk about it over the course of hours,
yeah.
right? You want, I mean, I do these like workshops and courses on anxiety, right? Yeah, I can explain it to you in 8 hours, right? Because
mm-hmm.
it's different for everybody and there's so many, you can't just, breathing doesn't work for everybody. For some people it makes it worse, right? Forming connections may not help everybody because connections feel painful. So, you know, you have all of these like, oh, do these coping skills, do these things. Yeah, but it's not one size fits all.
Because there's still so many other layers that you basically have to get through.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that, I don't want to be pessimistic. I know that feels daunting. I'm not trying to go like, oh, this is so horrible and there's no solution. I'm saying like any problem we're solving, it's not going to be simple. Mm-hmm. And if it's simple, maybe it's simple, but it's not easy. It's going to take work, right? So whether you're an individual who's like, yeah, I've got some suicidal ideations, cool. Really important for you to own that. It's going to take some time. Mm-hmm. You need to do the work. It's going to be painful. You're going to need to show up for therapy for a while.
Yeah, and a lot of work outside of therapy too. 100%. Because therapy, you go once a week, that's 1 hour, and then there's a lot of time outside of that 1 hour that's going to have a lot of work that's going to be done.
100%, right. So I don't want to be doom and gloom. I just want to impart upon people the seriousness of a conversation around, mm-hmm. like, how do we reduce or prevent suicide? Okay. You ready? Some mm-hmm. work to do.
Yeah.
And that's okay. We can do that. We can do that on an individual basis or a family basis or a collective basis. But we need to show up. And showing up means if this person feels really suicidal, they're feeling really disconnected. They're feeling disconnected from themselves, mm-hmm. from their family, from the world around them. Can we look inward and go, in what ways do I feel disconnected? How can I relate to this disconnection? What do I need to do in my life to address that? How can I help this person address that? But the real power is, I can't change them, but I can change me. So that, I mean, I would ask people to reflect on that. Like, in what ways are you disconnected? And mm-hmm. most of the time, that's a really hard question. And that, you can spin on that because you go, so many ways, yeah, cool. So let's do the work. Let's ask for help. Let's start unwinding it.
Now, you're also starting an app, mm-hmm. right? A mental health app. Can you speak more to that? Because I think that kind of relates to maybe even some of that building that connection, doing that work outside of the therapy. I mean, I think that could kind of maybe relate to some of that too.
Yeah. So the app for me was born out of, I only have 30 clinical hours a week. Mm-hmm. And I see the stuff I'm doing, you know, IFS, EMDR, the relationships I'm building with my clients, right?
So we did talk a little bit about what you mentioned what IFS is. So just so people, if they're not clinicians, yes. like, so what else can you, I know you also mentioned DBT and EMDR. So can you also just do like a little, just brief, I guess, like, overview of it?
So dialectical behavioral therapy is sort of like cognitive behavioral therapy mm-hmm. with mindfulness. Right. So dialectical behavioral therapy says it's not this or that. It's mm-hmm. this and that. Right. I'm sad and I'm connected. Yeah, you can have you're right. It doesn't like I'm not totally disconnected or totally connected. Right. There's some again, we call it a dialectic. It's not an opposite. It's a dialectic. A dialectic is two halves of a whole. So mm-hmm. Hot and cold are opposites. Temperature is the dialectic. You know, mm-hmm. when you put water in your bathtub, it's hot water plus cold water, right? And it creates warm right. water, right? So anyway, teaching people, DBT teaches people very tangible skills, like how can I be more effective with other people? How can I regulate my emotions better? How can I learn how to tolerate distress better? How can I learn mindfulness and grow awareness, right? So that's DBT. EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization reprocessing. If I had to pick, if you said, Matt, you can only do one therapy for the rest of your life, I love IFS, mm-hmm. but I think I'd pick EMDR. And what I've seen in EMDR, long story short, you get a trained clinician, they help facilitate particular, usually eye movements, bilateral movements, mm-hmm. which means left side, right side. So walking is a bilateral process where you're left foot, right mm-hmm. foot. And this helps increase the communication within the different hemispheres of your brain and improve different ways different systems are functioning. But in EMDR, we take this bilateral process and we apply it to the resolution of trauma. Basically, the idea is your brain is self-healing in the same way where if you break a bone, mm-hmm. you know, the doctor doesn't fix the bone. The doctor sets right. the cast, right? The bone regrows itself. Right, good news, your brain wants to grow, it wants to heal, mm-hmm. but it has to be given the right conditions. If you're constantly being re-traumatized, those aren't the right conditions, right, for healing. So we facilitate this, you know, bilateral movement in EMDR, and we help people work through their trauma. So I'm seeing all of this different work being done in my office, right? Or online since COVID, right? And I'm going, I got to do more, right? And not, again, not like a compulsive, I have to do more. Yeah. I've done a lot of trauma work. Yeah. You know, and there's more to do. But I did EMDR for, and still occasionally do, for 4 years. So I've dug into my shadow parts, right? And I've done a lot of work. And what, you know, 6 years ago would have been, I must do this in order to be successful, is now like, this is just the natural, organic next mm-hmm. step. And for me, the natural, organic next step is, how can I get some dose of this technology that I've seen improving people's lives into the hands of as many people as possible?
Yeah.
So that we can start making dents and small improvements.
More right? accessible for people, too.
100%. How can we, you know, a session with me is not cheap. A session with you is not cheap, right? An hour is, you know, $200, right?
Yeah.
Whew. What if I could get some small dose of this more consistently, you know, for $30 a month?
Mm-hmm.
Great. That's somewhere to start, right? So you would compare it to a meditation app, but it's not meditation. A lot of people find meditation really difficult to get into. So my app is called, our app, it's not mine, our app is called Recess.
Mm-hmm.
You can reach us at withrecess.com. Recess spelled R-E-C-E-S-S, like going out.
Yeah, like going outside for recess.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right. Which is very tempting for high performers. I would love a recess, right? And it uses a small dose, 10 minutes a day, of this bilateral technology to help improve focus,
mm-hmm.
productivity, self-worth, and decrease stress. And we've had our first beta. It's been super successful. We saw a subjective self-report of 50% increased focus after the use of the app. So that's, I mean, incredible. Imagine.
So when you say focus, are you talking about like executive functioning, ADHD, as well as the emotional stuff with the anxiety, depression, and trauma, and so forth?
And they're interconnected, right? Yeah. We know that focus is mediated by emotion. Mm-hmm. So all the way back to your comment, you know, the grit and emotional intelligence, right?
Yes.
Discipline's a limited resource. You can only force yourself so far, right? But creating positive emotion, mm-hmm. All the research shows negative emotion works great for short term. Positive emotion is what drives long term success. So if I can.
Yeah, it's like dopamine. It's going to release that dopamine because it's like,
100%. And the serotonin, mm-hmm. which is the I'm okay where I'm at, right? Yeah. You need the balance. Too much go, too much dopamine. Is not, you know, people will use dopamine to numb out serotonin issues,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, oh, I've got my checklist or I've got my, you know, achievement, right? But I don't feel okay where I'm at, right? So we need that balance between, and you know, it's more complicated than just dopamine and serotonin. Anyway, so so people can use the app and they can hopefully, it's not trauma therapy. It's not EMDR. That's not the point at all. You need to go to see an EMDR clinician for that. But what it is an accessible dose that the regular average Joe can use to promote the things in their life that are most important, right? Greater sense of self, decreased stress,
right.
Greater ability to focus, whether that's focusing on email or focusing on relationships,
right?
Whatever that looks like for you.
Yeah. And where can you find that again?
Withrecess.com.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening today, and thank you again to Matt Schwartz for providing your clinical knowledge. So if you are struggling with self-harm and suicidal thoughts, please call the suicide hotline at 988. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the Psych Confidential podcast, share it with others, or leave a rating and review. You can find more information on my clinic page, which is www.brightpinepsychology.com. And to catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on social media at @drkat_psyd. I hope you find this information useful, and I wish you all a great week. Until next time, this is Dr. Kat.